Ho, ho, copyright infringement. And we're back. Welcome to Mike, and Oscar, the post-Christmas edition. We're finally in the studio again, getting down to it. I am your host, Mike. This is my co-host.
We love this. We're caffeinated. We love you.
For the next 20 minutes.
We love mermen.
You love mermen. I could say definitively, my brother does not love mermen.
We saw this with Mike's brother. We enjoyed that.
We're talking
movie watching experience.
Talking today about the Guillermo del Toro passion project. Why not? The Shape of Water. What shape does water take, Mike?
It envelops all of you.
That's yeah, it sure point. Does.
It's like love. That's the poem.
There was no love in this movie. The Shape of Water in our Oscar sprint profile. That's my co-host also, Mike, since he didn't drop his own name.
Oh, by the way, I dropped my own name, yeah.
But we're doing The Shape of Water, Oscar sprint profile, and getting back on the horse. We're laced up and ready to go. We're off and sprinting towards the 2018 Oscars.
That was a Richard Jenkins-like gasp by you were there. There was a lot of emoting you did during it as well.
I feel like you're sent from like...
We're just here to heckle you at the beginning.
You're sent from an advertising company to just keep having callbacks to different things. And it's fucking beautiful. I wish I had that kind of mentality. But as we are, Shape of Water is what we're going to do today in the Oscar Sprint profile. We're not going to waste much time here at the top. Mike's going to give us the production profile. We're going to get right into it and talk about some fish love.
I name a lot of things profiles. What does that say anything about me?
What do you call it when you stand sideways? Your
silhouette? Sorry.
Let me provide a little context before Mike starts the production profile, because this movie desperately needs some for lay people to understand what the hell went on.
Don't say anything I'm going to say.
The...
Merman.
It's a very artistically driven... It's a straightforward script in that...
It's a fairy tale.
Yeah. Beautiful. Mike said it in one word. It's a fairy tale. All right, so you're gonna hear some off the wall stuff, even in the non spoiler section, which is what we're gonna do with the first part. Then we're gonna give you the little disco drop. We'll do spoilers later on in this episode, but this is gonna be our non spoiler review. We're gonna start with the production profile for this Guillermo del Toro fairy tale fantasy world. Go ahead, Mike.
Del Toro loves to play with fairy tale conventions, fables, if you will. I mean, he did that quite a bit in Pan's Labyrinth, which is basically a little cutesy kid fairy tale about finding the haunted house like Hansel and Gretel, except it's during like this World War II epic.
Yeah.
And it's just this horrifying mix
of
the two of those storylines. A crazy movie. If you haven't seen that one, do see it.
Just plates of LSD being passed around
on
set. Oh my
God. To me, The Shape of Water has like five clear antecedents. You know, your brother mentioned Beauty and the Beast.
Yes.
So no question about it. Beauty and the Beast is involved here. Yes, Guillermo del Toro is obsessed with James Whale's Frankenstein from 1931. He's obsessed with a lot of those old Universal Studios monster movies.
How do you feel about The Mummy this past year?
I did not see it.
How do you think he felt? Think he watched Tom Cruise run around in Mission Impossible
Mummy?
He's
been like rumored to direct Guillermo del Toro every one of these monster movies that are
He's playing it beautifully
coming
too
out.
Because if he never does it, they'll always want him to.
Well, guess what? I have some more information on that in a second. But I see Amelie with Sally Hawkins' character here, as well as Slash Filmcast. They
You're such
that.
A critic.
But dude, Splash, Tom Hanks, John Candy, Daryl Hannah. I mean, this is essentially...
Really? All right.
A remake of Splash. Oh, my God. And a clear borrowing from the premise of Creature from the Black Lagoon. So let's see how I did.
And Hellboy.
Well, yes. No, you know what? I had Hellboy written down because your brother mentioned again. He had a lot of nuggets
from
your brother
on this. He
had a lot to say. Guest starring? The other...
Pseudonym?
Mr. Pseudonym? Yeah, I mean, Hellboy's Doug Jones. Basically wear the same costume?
It's very similar. And even if you've never seen Hellboy, the resemblance is striking.
They kind of enhanced it. I will say they enhanced it.
Yeah, there's more to it, but it's same actor, same type of character.
But yeah, Michael Shannon's name in The Shape of Water, his character's name is Colonel Richard Strickland, and Richard Carson played the hero from Creature of the Black Lagoon. Richard Carson's character dragged the creature from the Black Lagoon out of the Amazon, right? Or fought him in the Amazon. And here, Richard Strickland Michael Shannon drags the character out of the Amazon into the secret lab in not so secret lab with terrible security in Baltimore, Maryland, and in the Shape of Water.
Easter eggs are what you find hidden around your house when the Easter Bunny comes.
Del Toro comes up with this idea over breakfast with Daniel Krauss. He's one of the co-authors of Del Toro's four novels, one of his four novels, Troll Hunters.
Big hit on Netflix.
Yeah, it has similarities. The Shape of Water has similarities to Del Toro's short film, The Space Between Us.
The Space Between.
And Rachel Ingall's novel, Mrs. Caliban.
I have nothing
apparently.
For that one.
Yeah, so far, no good for my theories. But wait, it was primarily inspired, says Wikipedia, by Del Toro's Memories of the Creature from the Black Lagoon, which I researched was re-released in the 1970s after its 1954 or 56 original release.
There you go. Got some Universal Monster movies. Leave them in the past, maybe. Stop trying to keep digging them up.
In fact, Del Toro was long into talks with Universal to remake The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And rumor has it, he wanted to make the movie from the creature's perspective. But studio executives rejected the idea and basically kind of rechanneled them into making this movie. Oh my God. So Del Toro wanted to set it in the 1960s Cold War era, which he's done with The Shape of Water.
Yep.
Figuring that audiences would let their guards down a little bit because it would become a fairy tale about troubled times. So that's the uniqueness of this setting.
The times have nothing to do with this movie.
Del Toro said in an interview for IndieWire that, I quote, "This movie is a healing movie for me. For nine movies, I rephrased the fears of my childhood, the dreams of my childhood, and this is the first time I speak as an adult about something that worries me as an adult." Mike is chomping at the bit to say something, but I'm not going to let him. The quote keeps going. "I speak about trust, otherness, sex, love, where we're going. Those are not concerns I ever had when I was nine or seven."
It's an allegory for interracial relationships. Just say it. I mean, that's what it is.
It is.
We're all human.
It's a bit of an allegory. I don't know if. Well, we'll definitely hit on this in spoilers. We got something to say. To finish kind of the Del Toro miniature profile here, his filmography includes Kronos, Mimic, The Devil's Backbone, Blade 2, Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, Pacific Rim, and Crimson Peak.
Those are not a whole lot going on in the last decade for him.
Well, I mean, Pacific Rim.
Directorial, anyway.
A lot of movies that have kind of fallen short at the box office. I mean, Pan's Labyrinth was his critical success, nominated for Best Academy Award. I don't think it.
But
that
was years ago.
I think it did win.
That was years
anyway,
ago.
Hellboy 2 was kind of a box office flop. Pacific Rim didn't make great money in the theaters, but I think it made money on video.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're in the process. I don't know if it's shot already, but I know a sequel is forthcoming for that.
So Del Toro produced The Orphanage. Beautiful, the drama.
Orphanage got a lot of great reception from critics.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that movie. J.A. Bayona, who's doing the new Jurassic Park movie, which doesn't look great, but he's finally really starting to...
Cancel Chris Pratt?
No, I mean, the preview didn't look great, yeah. I mean...
Cancel Steven Spielberg?
I mean, I just mean, you know, my foot is in my mouth.
Cancel the T-Rex.
I was actually at the New York Film Festival screening of The Orphanage. The director was sitting right behind me. And just a short little story. I just filmed the student film with my brother, Dave. My producer was sitting next to me, the kid who produced it, my friend Aris. And so the director and the actress are sitting right behind us and the screenwriter. Yeah. So it's like three of them sitting literally right behind us at the top row. I don't know how this happened, but it happened. And one of the biggest scares of the movie, I freaked out and I turned around and I gave like a fist wag at the director. And he just said to me, "I got you." And it was so funny. It was like a great moment for me.
That's awesome.
It's the only good moment for me. No, but
it's been downhill ever since.
So yes, and Del Toro produced that movie, The Orphanage.
My mother died. Yes, The Orphanage.
Put up very billboards.
Very well received.
Beautiful. The B I-U-T-I, if you will. That
spells it a little differently.
Javier Bardem Oscar-nominated performance in that one.
2011, after his turn in No Country for Old Men.
Andy Muschietti's Mama was also produced by Guillermo del Toro. He's gone on to direct It, that we both loved as a horror movie.
Film of the year, go look at it.
And then he's produced Kung Fu Panda 2 and Puss in Boots.
Also films of the year, go, no.
He's written four novels, Guillermo del Toro, The Strain, The Fall, The Night Eternal, and Troll Hunters. So this is an eclectic filmography.
Troll Hunters, already a TV show. The Strain, already a TV show.
I mean, he's done some heavy dramas. So this is like saying Jane Austen's Emma, Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham, and Vampire Blood Orgy 6 were directed by the same person.
I preferred number 4.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to write a bio on this guy, but I kept going back to his insane descriptions of his man caves. The amount of memorabilia that this guy collects is just absurd. This guy owns 2 extra houses to stash.
Oh, when you have that much stuff, why not, right?
He couldn't put it in one man cave.
Yeah.
he owns 2 extra houses, and I quote, solely for the purpose of housing books, poster artwork, and other movie, and in particular, old Hollywood monster memorabilia.
Where do you put your books?
In my other home. So a man cave wasn't enough. And then he says this weird quote. So this is interesting. And I like,
ask not what your country.
As a kid, Guillermo del Toro, as a kid, I dreamed of having a house with secret passages and a room where it rained 24 hours a day. I mean, this is like a H.H. Holmes.
I was just going to make that comparison.
Anyway, the point of being over 40 is to fulfill the desires you've been harboring since you were 7. Now, he says it in the most jovial way possible, but written down.
That's said by a guy with money.
That sounds terrible.
That's
said
by a guy that can fulfill those fantasies.
Pay our bills, Christ almighty. So, kind of a WTF quote there, a little weird.
Don't look too deeply into it. Don't look too deeply into anything Guillermo del Toro does, I don't think. You're going to find some creepiness.
Notice we haven't tried to do an impression, because that would just be...
Yeah. Although, him in Always Sunny, his turn as Grandpappy McPoyle in Always Sunny in Philadelphia, hysterical.
I don't believe you.
He is outstanding.
This is like a shark jerk of the wheel off the road into a David Lynch movie. I don't know what's happening. Authoritarianism is often a villainous force in Del Toro movies.
And life.
So, Nazis, fascists. Yes, another
all
juicy...
All decent people, according to our president.
Another... Oh, God. You can't say that. Another juicy Del Toro quote coming here, and I quote, I hate structure. I'm completely anti-structural in terms of believing in institutions. I hate them. I hate any institutionalized social, religious, or economic holding.
How do you think he feels about Medicare?
I mean, every Democrat just clenched their butt while I was saying all that. Yeah, I don't know if he understands what being a liberal is, because he also says he's a little too liberal. And it shows.
Yeah, it sounds it.
And it shows. Yeah, but it shows. Yeah, he didn't get the whole Jefferson Adams debate.
Yeah,
in his 6th grade history class.
I take it he doesn't watch like news 24/7. CNN probably isn't on much.
Then
in his
again,
house.
This is why big government, small government debates aren't exactly framing the overall political discourse these
and
days.
And now we're completely off the trail. Doo da.
Car explodes. The beginning of a David Lynch movie. Anyway,
I wish.
I'm going to get into a couple miniature biographies. By a couple, I mean one, Sally Hawkins. Damn it.
She's getting a lot of pub. Sally Hawkins, the lead of Shape of Water. She is pretty much a big favorite right now. I would say either her or Frances McDormand for Three Billboards.
I'm surprised, because McDormand was leading it for a while. But yeah, I mean, her performance is pretty interesting. Anyway, to get into her brief biography, it's... Not that she's been alive for a short time, but my biography of her is
brief. I don't think you needed to clear that up.
I'm a huge fan, which doesn't mean I'm a large person. I'm a small guy, in fact. Sorry. Listen, Sally Hawkins was born in Dulwich. She was brought up in Blackheath, and she is the sister of Finbar. So she's And she got her start as a Shakespearean actress. So it's official.
Over some tea and crumpets.
She is the most British person who has ever lived by that biography.
Kenneth Branagh would like to speak to you.
Well, stereotypically British. In 1998, she was cast as an extra in Star Wars The Phantom Menace while she was still a student. Lots of theater, lots of theater. Then in 2002, her breakout role comes with Mike Lee's All or Nothing. This is the first of three collaborations with Lee, also including Vera Drake and Happy Go Lucky, where she wins the Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Comedy or Musical.
Is Mike Lee just Spike Lee's white alter ego?
Mike Lee's process is kind of weird. Like, he develops his scripts with his actors. Like, they just kind of play act in rehearsals until they come up with what the story's going to be. You got to watch like some special features on Mike Lee's Happy Go Lucky or something. Yeah. He's got a wild process. Anyway,
interesting to know.
Three movies with Mike Lee. She's also worked twice with Woody Allen, Cassandra's Dream, and again in Blue Jasmine, which she was nominated for an Oscar in.
Got a lot of love for that. That movie in general. Very, very heavily loved movie. Very, very sad movie.
So she's done the character actor thing in a lot of movies, even though she's kind of broken out a few times in between. It's almost like she has a revival every few years and her talents come to the fore because...
Very McDormand-esque, you know, goes away for a little bit, comes back in a big role, right. Gets a lot of love for it.
She just kind of takes juicy roles. She doesn't care if it's a character role or if it's a lead or supporting. Anyway, she's been in Layer Cake, where she was like one of the thugs. One of the criminal thugs. She was in An Education. She was in Never Let Me Go, playing one of the nurses. She was in Jane Eyre from the True Detective Season 1 director, Fukunaga. She's in Godzilla as another scientist. I guess she plays a lot of scientists. She's one of the family members in Paddington 1 and 2. I wouldn't know.
That's where she's really going to earn her money.
Okay. Well, you know, you're probably right. But she starred in some phenomenal performances this year and in the last few. Maudie, I can't say enough about her in that role. I mean, perhaps the most sympathetic character in the history of characters.
This is the film called Maudie? It's not one I'm familiar with.
She plays this disabled artist who's a true story. Anyway, it's a solid movie, I thought.
Yeah, not one I know, but
X and Y, Made in Dagenham. She's also starred
in
those
two. You could see there's... She jumps off the screen, and she doesn't say barely a word in this movie. She's phenomenal as an actor.
Quite the smile and egg timers. But anyway, The Shape of Water also stars Michael Shannon, Richard Jenkins, Michael Stuhlbarg, and Octavia Spencer. Each of those performances we're going to dive into before spoilers, I think, and then after spoilers. Each are characters that are written very well, that are really fleshed out characters in their own rights. They have fully completed arcs. So this supporting cast has a lot to bite into.
Yeah, and the chemistry amongst all the characters is really something. Especially there's a scene where Michael Shannon is confronting Octavia Spencer, and it's edge of your seat stuff.
They all have collisions. There's no question about it. The production notes, just one line of them. Filming began in August 2016 in Hamilton, Ontario, which is, I guess, in Canada.
Not familiar.
And it wrapped in November. So a lot of the promotional interviews have said that this was a long, grueling shoot. Del Toro has often joked that he's a very demanding director in terms of demanding of his producers, demanding of more budget. He's gone over budget on, notoriously several times over. He went over budget on this one.
When he does these Fantasyland pictures that are such a stark break from reality... essentially out of nowhere at some points, like in this movie, you gotta put all that you need into it to prove that you're in a dream sequence or, you know, go off color or go more with effects and stuff like that. And he does it.
He makes genre movies. There's no question about it. Sometimes that requires more money. Anyway, you got the specs, Mikey?
Yeah, let's talk about some numbers with this film. The Shape of Water, written by Guillermo del Toro and Vanessa Taylor. They both wrote the screenplay. It was based off a del Toro story, directed, of course, by Guillermo, which Mike said. Last 10 years of Guillermo del Toro's directorial debut, Mike did it in specifically, just to go over it generally. Hellboy 2 was in 2008, Pacific Rim in 2013. Two episodes of The Strain on FX in 2015. Two episodes of Trollhunters on Netflix in 2016. That's been his last decade directorially. So he has,
mentioned Crimson Peak.
Crimson. I did not. Crimson Peak as well. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's my fault.
Which was, I mean, what it, I didn't love.
Mixed
it.
Reviews. I mean, very the problem mixed. Is it's like
a ghost story. Well, there's like a ghost story in that movie that's totally inconsequential to the final plot.
Yeah.
It's like, why do we just go through all that stuff with the ghost in the middle in the house? And then it all comes down to the family stuff at the end. I don't get it.
Because Guillermo del Toro is a scary man. Film debuted August 31st at the Venice Film Festival and went otherwise in the U.S. on December 1st, only going wide recently. You had that date.
December 22nd.
December 22nd, just around Christmas time last week. Distributed by Fox Searchlight. We said it in the Three Billboards podcast that if A24 isn't the production company that's having the big distribution year, it's Fox Searchlight. Those seem to be at the top of all the awards list. They have to get their hands on that.
Yep, a lot of campaigning.
It's reportedly a $19.5 million budget. Pretty substantial for a small picture like this.
For an art film, it'll probably make its money back.
As of 12/26, it has brought in $9 million domestically.
Yeah, it's going to go wider and wider. Foreign, it's going to make money.
Just started going wide.
Like, I think Three Billboards, Shape of Water, Lady Bird. Well, Lady Bird kind of went really wide, and now it's coming back. But they might go wide again for one more kind of boost after the Star Wars mania for the end of the month here.
Towards Oscar season. And with it not going as wide yet, it has an extremely high IMDb rating. It's 8.2 IMDb rating, only 8,000 reviews there. On a hunch, with it going wider, I'm going to say that as it gets more publicity and more of a push, that more eyes are going to see it. And with more eyes on the product, I'm going to guess a lot of fair weather movie fans aren't going to accept it. I know that you said that walking out of the theater yesterday, you heard a split between a guy and a girl. You want to tell that quick?
On the Slash Filmcast, one of the male critics didn't like it, and the only female critic loved it. So this is how I draw conclusions in real life, folks. Because that happened again as I walked out of the theater early. The one girl I listened to goes, "I love it." And her boyfriend, very obviously her boyfriend with her arm wrapped around her, goes, "That sucked."
So that's the breakdown.
So in my cross-section of four people, I think that men don't like it and women like it.
Leave no stone unturned in our research. But that's the breakdown. I imagine as more people get eyes on it, the rating might drop some. Not to say anything about the quality of the movie itself. If it does sustain its 8.2 IMDb rating, that would rank it just outside of the IMDb top 250 list. It is certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes with a 93%, an 8.4 critics rating from 233 critics, audience score of 84%, and an audience average of 4.1 out of 5, as long as it does have an 86 meta rating from Metacritic.
I mean, dude, how is this movie less controversial than Star Wars?
We're going to get into it.
We're going to get into it in spoilers.
As far as awards chatter goes, this is a big one. We've mentioned in our Golden Globes recap, episode 16, I want to say.
15.
Did I get it wrong still?
Yes.
Episode 15, good God.
We looked it up. We
that
stopped and looked it
eight
up.
Eight takes to get that number right, and I still got it wrong. Episode 15.
15.
All right, 15 in our Golden Globes review. It's beloved. It's a very heavily favored 16. Movie amongst the critics. It leads both the Critics' Choice Awards and the Golden Globes in total nominations amongst all movies for those shows. 7 noms for the Globes for Best Screenplay, Supporting Actress Octavia Spencer, Original Score for Alexandra Desplat, Supporting Actor for Richard Jenkins, Best Actress in a Drama, Sally Hawkins, Best Director, Best Picture Drama, and an astounding 14 Critics' Choice nominees. I'm going to take a deep breath because I'm actually going to do these. Ready? Best Editing!
All of them.
Best Editing, Best Costume Design, Best Hair and Makeup, Best Sci-Fi Horror, Best Visual Effects, Best Cinematography, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor for Octavia Spencer, Best Supporting Actor for Richard Jenkins, Best Lead Actress Sally Hawkins, Best Production Design, Best Score by Desplat, and Best Picture. Suffice to say, this is a very popular movie for nominations.
If you look at the Wikipedia page, the IMDb page, and look at the awards that it's won and that it's been nominated for, I mean, it's almost just like listing off cities in the country.
It's like what critic circles exist.
The critics love this movie. They've nominated the hell out of it. And like you said, yeah, the Critics' Choice Award and the Golden Globes really liked it.
Further with this movie, it made the AFI top 10 list. So we're dealing with another very, very highly regarded by all, basically, anyone that ranks movies.
All the AFI people,
And while Jenkins and Hawkins also landed themselves SAG nominations for their respective categories.
How do we become an AFI person? American Film Institute.
Just keep making podcasts.
We have to be institutionalized at the American Film.
We're on our way. If there's a Critics Awards, like Mike said, from a locale, you can bet this movie has a minimum of two nominations on the list. The ones that seems to be most prevalent are Guillermo del Toro for Best Director and a Best Picture nom coming for this. Those are the two biggest that seem likely. Sally Hawkins for Best Lead Actor and Original Screenplay seem to have the next two biggest shots. And finally, Richard Jenkins and Octavia Spencer. Jenkins more so than Spencer, I would say, at this point, seem to be getting the pushes from the studios for their supporting roles as well.
Yeah, Feinberg Forecast has it up for all those categories that Mike was mentioning as a front runner, with the exception of Octavia Spencer and Original Screenplay. It also has it up there as Film Editing and Best Production Design. So in terms of a front running or major contendership, it's in the mix.
It's a big one. Yeah, this is one that's definitely going to hear its name come Oscar nomination season.
The experts on Gold Derby, and Gold Derby's essentially polls the best of the film critics out there. 25 of 27 have it up for Best Picture. Two of them have it at number one. 24 out of 26 for Best Director. Seven have Guillermo del Toro as their number one choice.
In a year with Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk and Jordan Peele Get Out and Greta Gerwig Lady Bird. Man.
I don't see that either. But 27 out of 27 have Sally Hawkins in the five for Best Actress.
You're going to see Hawkins and Frances McDormand. I'm telling you. Those are the two head-to-head.
Six of them have Hawkins at number one. 20 out of 27 have Richard Jenkins for Best Supporting Actor. One of those experts have him at number one. I think he's gaining momentum.
We'll talk about that as we go through, because I have an issue with his nomination, his being the choice for the supporting actor nomination.
Yeah, a lot of good performances in this one. 10 out of 27 have Octavia Spencer still in there. She's kind of fallen out a little bit. I don't know why that's happening, but it is happening, it seems.
We're going to allude to this when we release the Three Billboards, in the same way that Woody Harrelson is kind of getting chastised for playing a Woody Harrelson role. Octavia Spencer kind of getting a little bit of chastising for the critics for playing an Octavia Spencer role.
But it's also just nutty people voting body stuff, because we had Holly Hunter kind of literally fall out of the race a little bit, and then she doesn't get a Golden Globe nomination. Next thing you know, she's right back in front of Gold Derby because there's a backlash to the
backlash against
the
backlash.
Well, yeah, she was snubbed, and then there's a backlash. Was that, and could that timing get her a nomination? Because everybody's like, oh my God, the Big Sick didn't get this, and now we're
humans. Yeah, anytime you're relying on human subjectivity, you're bound to see a lot of oddities.
So to finish up the Gold Derby stats, 19 out of 26 experts on Gold Derby have this movie up for Best Original Screenplay, so those are the categories we cover. Like you said, it's up for a lot of technical awards, and that's our production profile.
It's going to be fun to see, too, with like effects and makeup and stuff, this versus a Star Wars, see if those come out for when Oscar night happens.
Right.
Yeah, so let's get into our expectations. What were your expectations for this fish fucking movie?
I did not expect a good movie, honestly, because Crimson Peak was not, I was not a fan of that. And
that's
I told
what
you
I brought up for his last 10 years. He's not had a big hit.
I loved Pan's Labyrinth back in the day.
15 years ago, yep.
And I had a problem with his last decade. Yeah, I'm not a fan of The Strain. I mean,
I watched it. It didn't capture me. I wasn't crazy about it myself.
I like watching interviews of this guy. I love his choices in terms of what he's making movies about and making TVs and shows about and writing novels about. I mean, I think it's very cool that you got a guy who's telling fairy tales in terms of a rated R superhero genre or a rated R vampire TV show. I mean,
I could tell you what his best directorial work has been in the last 10 years. And it was, I'm more of a video game guy than you are, so this appealed to me, and I don't know, it might have gone unnoticed by you, but he directed the playable demo for Silent Hill 10, and it was starring Norman Reedus, and it was bringing back the Silent Hill franchise. It hit the air, and everyone could download it and play it if they wanted. It was called Silent Hill 10, and people lost their minds. It was so scary and unnerving and just crazy to play through. Then they ended up dropping the title altogether. It wouldn't be released at all as a full video game. But that, I mean, that's Guillermo del Toro. The creating of suspense and fear and dread and just scariness. It was beautiful. And it's everything you wanted him to do since Pan's Labyrinth. But he just hasn't done it yet. So,
Silent Hill 10, is that like or unlike Mario Kart and Zelda? That was the last time I played video games.
My heart.
Madden 96 is any similarities with what you just said?
But yes, to your point, his last decade has been more missed than hit for us. But he is an interesting guy, and we know he's very capable of great things.
Well, he's been doing a ton of stuff. So is it a saturation thing? Like, he's doing too much?
Is it a studio thing?
He's producing 20 movies. He's writing novels or co-writing them. You know, he's directing a novel. He's directing a movie every 2 years. You know, he's directing video games, apparently.
Is he getting the budget he wants from these studios?
Buying houses and filling it with memorabilia.
Just throwing books in them. Yeah, he's up to a lot. You're right. As far as expectations for me, I knew it was a Guillermo del Toro movie. I knew it was a movie about a sea creature. I knew it was a love story. I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't really have expectations because I didn't really know more than it was a love story and a government was involved somehow. But I don't know.
This I will tell you one weird. Thing. So the first trailer was kind of lighthearted.
Yes.
And it was emphasizing the romance.
Yes.
The first trailer. And then the second one was kind of emphasizing the action movie take on it, kind of the escape of the
chase,
asset,
yeah.
Right? The prison break aspect of it. So I kind of really liked the second trailer, even though the finished product of the movie kind of was more like the first trailer. It's a little bit of both.
It's a weird movie. It's a weird watch. It's a trip. Not in a bad way either. It's a trip.
So, I mean, I guess we'll jump into the production values. Visual effects were excellent, I thought.
That's where I wanted to go with production values. I mean, anything on Doug Jones. Doug Jones is a master.
Yeah, he plays so all these it's weird really cool. characters. Like, there's a good mix in this movie of CGI, which they did a nice job with, right? I mean, just the first sequence alone, you're wondering, I was like, did they film this underwater?
Yeah.
Or did they use some special camera effect where all this stuff is underwater? Because that looks darn like
legit,
Sally Hawkins,
yeah.
Right?
Does she have gills?
Did she hold her breath for 15 seconds?
Is Sally Hawkins a fish person?
floating in the water? Or is that a computer effect? And then you have the computer effects mixed with the amphibian man character, right? Like sometimes his face is obviously animated in a certain way. I don't know if they did all the pixels and stuff like
his
Star
body
Wars.
Emits a certain type of energy at some points. It looked pretty natural.
Right. So I don't know if those are actual lights or that's a computer effect. I mean, they're fooling me. And I'm going to be honest. I bought that character from start to finish, like as being in the frame with them.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned it already. It's going to be interesting to see all kinds of makeups and effects and where they ranked against Star Wars, because it is that visually striking at points. I mean, Star Wars was beautifully done and it had such a contrast, a bright contrast of colors and different areas. And then this movie comes along and it shows this sea creature brought to life in the real world,
right?
For as much as the real world exists here.
But the ghosts in Crimson Peak and the ghosts in the Devil's Backbone and the bad guys in the Hellboy 2 and the giant robots are so obviously animated,
right,
in his other movies that this was like a nice mix.
Yeah, it does bring up questions as to whether it's practical or kind of some kind of special effects going on.
Like I thought Blade 2 was kind of a good mix too. Like it was obvious.
It's been years since I've seen
but
that.
But yeah, but I got to see it again, I guess, but that movie was cool and that you got a lot of blood splatter, but you also got, you know, CGI vampire stuff.
Right. I mean, and look, the obvious criticism about the sea creature or fish man, as I'll call him, Doug Jones's character is
Kanye West in South Park.
Yeah. The obvious criticism is one that my brother hammered over and over. It's that it's Abe Sapien 2.0 from the Hellboy series. You know, people say he's just a ripoff of Doug Jones's character from Hellboy. There are obviously striking resemblances, but it's a different enough character. It didn't bother me.
Is Abe Sapien a ripoff of all the monster, a creature from the Blue Lagoon talk that he was having with the studio?
Or is Guillermo del Toro a time traveler?
Is he a hobbit? He lost the Hobbit. I forgot to mention that. I mean, this guy, his decade's been jam-packed because he was supposed to do all the Hobbit movies. He wrote them and he actually got credit
for
writing
the first
Hobbit.
I feel
like
he's one of those people that, like, anytime there's a IP out there floating in the wind that's gaining momentum, his name at some point is going to be attached to possibility.
It would have been a good job by me, which I didn't do, to actually know and understand what Guillermo del Toro did wrong to get himself kind of exiled from those Hobbit movies. What? Or did he leave them? I don't remember.
What Peter Jackson you do around here?
Peter Jackson takes over the Hobbit prequels,
right,
to the Lord of the Rings. And does he phone it in because Guillermo del Toro was handpicked by Peter Jackson? You know, he's passing the torch, getting the torch passed. Peter Jackson doesn't make good movies after it. King Kong, The Lovely Bones. So he doesn't find any more momentum. So, okay, let me take a shot where I'm comfortable again. And take
which
this
in
back
and of
over.
Itself is interesting because a Peter Jackson trilogy and a Guillermo del Toro trilogy, we would think are going to have very vastly different looks. And tones. And
it's weird because Guillermo del Toro makes Hellboy 2 the Golden Army, and there's like this little character who lives in a hole in the ground, but it's not called a hobbit. And there's this whole mythology behind Hellboy.
Bitch,
which
you sure
like,
you're not a hobbit?
You're quoting South Park this time. I've spread the disease, the wonderful disease. Anyway, Pan's Labyrinth, Kronos. Like, the better Del Toro movies use more practical effects, in my opinion. That's just the way it's playing out for me. And the goofier ones, the ones that don't land with me, like Pacific Rim or Hellboy 2, they don't.
And they go on the CGI route. And that's something we hammer time and time. It's become a running theme. I'm sure you can make a t-shirt of it for this podcast that, you know, practical effects win the day. They just look better.
If you can pull them off, do it. Yep. Sally Hawkins, if she's acting next to a green screen, you know, it's not going to work. So she has to do all these nonverbal. So these are actor intensive scenes, right?
Yes.
Where she can't speak.
Sally Hawkins plays a mute, but she can hear. She can communicate through sign language.
The amphibian man is not speaking, yep. And he's just trying to learn a few lines of sign language from her. So and then this is like a throwback monster movie, but on its head, because now you got a romantic subplot brought to the forefront instead of King Kong and Naomi Watts kind of almost thinking maybe he likes her, or, you know, it's just a metaphor for something horrible, or which it wasn't King Kong. But this is right to the forefront. You know, this is, you know, will they, won't they?
Yeah, the love story was definitely the big overarching storyline. The other two storylines that came out of this movie, I thought, were the chase, which we touched on, the location of the asset, where does it go? We'll get more into that in spoilers. And the overt sexuality of the script. I mean, this movie, if you want to say it's about love, that's fine, but there are some moments it's not about love. It's just about sex and, like, masturbation, dirty, filthy. I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, carnal.
Surprising.
Yeah, carnal desires.
It's an adult fairy tale. Yeah. It's a very much an adult fairy tale, which was surprising, I agree. But cinematography, that's a very pretty movie to look at. If I hear one more person during the promotional interviews of any film call that movie lovely, I want to punch them. I'm starting to hate the word lovely. That's just probably a me problem.
I wouldn't describe it as lovely.
Well, I will say that
it was nice. It was a nice movie.
It was good.
Yeah.
It was good.
A nice movie to look at.
It had good visuals.
I don't know. I mean, cinematography wise, you know, I'm more impressed with the effects than I am with cinematography. He shoots the water very well. I mean,
it's always raining.
Yes, well,
which is nice to look at.
Surprisingly, The Shape of Water did not take place in the desert. Threw me for a loop just as well. I don't know. I'm not writing home about the cinematography of this movie. I think Christopher Nolan has really soured me towards a lot of the cinematography this year, and a lot of Hans Zimmer has done the same
Star
with scores.
Wars, Blade Runner. Yeah, there's a lot of movies that are up there. Yeah. I'm going to be ticked off if this movie beats Dunkirk cinematography.
That should
just win for the IMAX. Like, he did it 19 million. I mean, here's the thing. Like, pound for pound, this guy makes a movie look this good with 19 million. Nolan makes it look that good with 100 million. What do you take? Are you making a decision on pound for pound, this is a better use of the dollars? Or are you making a decision on this is the better product at the end of the day, no matter how much money you spend? And I think
that's
people
the subjectivity
weigh,
of the voting. Yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
people
you don't know.
Weigh that.
I think. They do. I think you're absolutely right. I don't think there's a blueprint for how they're going to vote, and so who knows what the outcome is going to be.
Last year, nothing looked better than Moonlight for, you know, a couple million, right? And
yeah, no, it's very well made.
But Star Wars Rogue One just blows your hair back because it's so overwhelming of a spectacle.
And then you have something like The Dark Knight years ago that doesn't even get noticed for it.
Right.
So
right.
Who knows?
So we both landed on makeup and visual effects there. Cinematography is. Would we be upset if it got nominated?
Meh. I don't have strong feels either way on cinematography, yeah.
Costumes, in terms of the throwback 60s look, the Cold War
look.
Why
not? I bought it.
I thought that worked.
Yeah, did a good job. Michael Shannon running around as the very pseudo-spy-looking
type
of guy.
Family, yeah. I mean, I don't know if the spy plots really worked for me, and that was kind of going to be...
It had a good payoff with the,
So, yeah, we'll get into it in spoilers, yeah. But my worst scene is going to involve that. Production design, I thought this was a very artsy, extra fartsy.
You think so,
tip
huh?
of the cap. But for me, it's a tip of the cap. There's so much shit falling on their heads in Three Billboards that it's almost comical.
Yes.
And in this one, there's almost so much that's, enjoyable, or I would say kind of irresistible, I think is the word. It's hard to dislike this, fairy tale.
I made a great joke there, and you just totally glossed over it.
Robert Palmer, irresistible. Okay, I get it now. I do that sometimes. I re-listen to the podcast, and I laugh at your jokes that I could just completely keep talking over.
Son of a bitch. Yes, I mean, there's a lot.
This is just you than me.
There's a lot to lap up in this movie. It's very easy. Your heart goes out to a woman like Sally Hawkins' character, right? It's someone you encounter in everyday life.
She's disabled. Yep. She's got the cutest smile in
the
world.
She's different, I say with air quotes. And right, then she's not so different, which is the underlying theme. I mean, it's true.
She's easy to relate character to. With a lot of agency on the one hand.
Oh, yeah.
Unexpected agency. Mm-hmm. But she's got these adorable friends. They're thoroughly adorable. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that as a cute sort of way, but you love those characters.
The innocence
Richard Jenkins' character
of both Richard Jenkins and Octavia Spencer.
You want to be his best friend, yeah. And Octavia Spencer, you want her to be your best friend. I mean, in the promotional videos, Del Toro told Octavia Spencer during their first meeting, "When you look at me, you make me feel as if I've been forgiven of all my sins."
Yeah, and that's displayed well. I mean, imagine Octavia Spencer playing, and I'm sure she can, she just hasn't thus far, playing an evil character. It's tough to picture right now because she's always that like strong, independent woman that has a very soft side to people who deserve it. And that's what she is in this movie.
Yeah, she's been the best friend in a couple movies, and she's the best friend character that you love in a lot of movies. So will she be rewarded for the same kind of character or not? I don't know.
It's going to be interesting to see, and her momentum seems to have slipped off a little bit in the Oscar race as far as that's concerned. Richard Jenkins is the guy that's kind of getting the big push right now. I mean, as we're going to talk more about performances, he's kind of the guy that the studio has at the forefront. If it's not Sally Hawkins for her lead performance, which we're going to talk a lot more about in spoilers, it's going to be Richard Jenkins for playing the best friend neighbor.
He's got some John Candy from Splash moments in this one.
Yeah,
we'll
talk
more about it. But if he didn't take it directly from Splash, he should have. Or he didn't do his homework.
Innocent guy in the history of cinema.
Richard Jenkins, yeah. He sells it.
In this movie.
And Jenkins has more subtlety to his performance than Sam Rockwell does, and I think after Three Billboards. So those are kind of the three main contenders right now, and I think Jenkins is kind of pulling in the lead for me, too.
You're talking Defoe in The Florida Project, Jenkins here, and Sam
Rockwell
in Three Billboards.
Surprisingly enough, I didn't expect that to happen for me, but yeah, I mean, Jenkins is gaining momentum, I think.
What about Michael Stuhlbarg? What'd you think of his? He was getting a little publicity for a while there.
He's having a good year. Again, they probably focused their campaign on Jenkins, because, kind of...
That like half grin he has throughout the whole movie. It's like, you are the guy from Boardwalk Empire, and you should be running a drug cartel in the 30s.
He's played a lot of unlikable characters in the past, like likable anti-heroes or unlikable characters. And here he is in a year giving that speech to Timothy Chalamet. Everybody loves him for that, and rightfully so. He says everything that you ever wanted to say to a Timothy Chalamet character, right? It's almost asking forgiveness as an audience surrogate for all the trials and tribulations the gay community and the LGBT community has gone through all over those years. So he gets the chance in a way that's, I don't know if that's a Hollywood half measure, we'll get to it, but it's a driving Miss Daisy kind of a moment, maybe. I don't know.
Gonna tease our Call Me By Your Name Oscar sprint profile there.
Michael Stuhlbarg also is a character that may or may not befriend, you know, these irresistible protagonists and group of friends in the movie.
He's a very interesting character in relation to what he does as a job and how you end up feeling about him as an audience member, which, again, I mean, we're teasing the spoilers a lot, but mention that.
We got to get through those two performances in spoilers, Shannon and Stuhlbarg.
Yeah, and Michael Shannon, we can't really say much of anything about because he is the antagonist of the movie. Yeah, that's probably fair.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious. I mean, he gave that old line during the promotional interview circuit that, you know, he never looked at the character as a villain. Del Toro told him that it was just a guy going through a lot of problems. And you know, you see that. And again, this is a good job of storytelling where you get a lot of the causality behind why he is the way he is and why he reacts wrongly to the crises that, you know, oppose his character. And it's another character with a full arc. I mean, I'm really dazzled by how each one of these main performances has such a full and complete and detailed arc to it. I mean, it's
how soon after the filming, primary filming of this wrap, do you think each of these people had fish sticks or ate salmon?
And that's an inside South Park joke for four of you. It's a great one, though. Anything else we want to say about Sally Hawkins before we don't watch this thing?
It's something we keep hammering here, but anytime there's an actor that's going to, like, ugly themselves up or play disabled character or put on an accent.
Beautiful makeup.
Or...
What are you saying?
Yes.
Or be 6 months pregnant? No.
I mean, yeah.
come on, Mike. This is guy 101 shit. What are you talking about?
I mean, ugly yourself up in the sense that she was here. You know, she was a disabled person. She couldn't speak. She had to do all her emoting through different sign languages and stuff. You know, anytime they do that, the Academy's going to take notice.
Irresistible. And she plays a great, empathetic character.
Oh, yeah.
I would agree. It's all the little moments with the fish man, all the big blowout emotional scenes with Richard Jenkins, and there's a couple, and then Octavia Spencer, she has a lot of the comic relief happens with
there
Octavia
are two
Spencer.
Scenes that just drive me insane, and
right.
We'll get to them, and they're very offbeat and they just made no sense in this course of this movie, and I hate them.
And you're among many.
Yeah, and if you've seen the movie, I'm sure you can guess which two they are. But
so, watch or don't watch, Mike?
What kind of mood are you in? You know, I mean, like, you can survive without having seen this movie. If you like the deep, dark fantasy stuff, if you like Guillermo del Toro's visions and what he's done, including the Strain stuff, including the stuff in the last decade, then yeah, because I don't think the mistakes made in this movie are so egregious that they make it unwatchable.
So you're saying if you like to curiosity watch movies in the
yeah.
sense that you don't care, you just want something unexpected?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a fun story here. Like, I gave it a good grade. It's a good movie to watch, but, you know, do you have to watch it? And 10 years from now, is this going to be the most memorable movie from this class? It might be for different reasons, but I don't think for the good reasons.
If this wins, like, the big awards...
Right.
We're going to debate this going forward. Is this kind of the compromise candidate?
Sure.
Could it
it's
be?
A good way of putting
it's
it.
Something that's like inane, but it says nice things.
Right.
Is it the driving
without
Miss
fully
Daisy
being,
versus do
yeah,
the right thing?
Yeah.
You know, Call Me By Your Name is a very in your face
as is Get
issue
Out.
Movie. So is Get Out.
Yeah.
So is Lady Bird.
Yeah.
I mean, even Dunkirk is that way as a war movie.
Right.
I just tried to pitch Dunkirk, but that's an obvious steak-eating movie.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. Can you survive without seeing it? Yes. I don't think you need to see it. But if you're curious, you want a curiosity, watch it. Yeah, go ahead.
It is a watch for me. And some of those questions that I asked Mike, if posed to myself, this is really getting circular. Mike, and Mike.
Mike, and then Mike on Mike.
Mike, and talking all about Mike.
Mike on Mike.
So, I'm... definitely in favor of watching this movie, but it might be because of those reasons. Curiosity watch. I mean, it was really intriguing. If I had a beard, I would stroke it.
10 years from now, I think we're going to remember this movie for the wrong reasons. is what I'll predict. But who knows? Time will tell.
Let's get into spoilers.
Yeah, let's hit the dance music, which is very appropriate for this movie. Spoilers ahead. Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. Spoilers.
All right, so this is the spoiler section of Shape of Water, or the amount of Sally Hawkins' water bill, as I call it. If you want to go to the non-spoiler section, go back the first 40, 50 minutes of this podcast. That's going to give you all the non-spoiler, all the specs, production profile, performance review, production values, everything you want non-spoiler-wise about this movie. But now, from here on out, we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of the story of this fish-loving movie, this love story of Beauty and the Beast with Finn, and we're going to talk about the spoilers of The Shape of Water.
Yeah, they are something that need... Mike is fuming and he's intimidating me. I'm quaking in my boots like my daddy's mad at the dinner table or something. No, you definitely... you got some things to say about your worst scene, so we'll start there.
We're gonna carry over. I do like this movie. I really do. But there are three scenes that I just cannot get past. One... Richard Jenkins in the pie shop, when you find out that the guy that owns the pie shop is a bad person. Okay, fine. We're all, you know, beauty isn't skin deep. You got to look past the surface of things. Not all people that seem good are good. Not all people that are different are bad. I get that message.
Right.
The black couple that comes in and wants to sit at the counter, why didn't you just put a bright neon flashing sign around the pie guy's neck that says racist too?
Yeah, it's very obvious.
So out of place.
He might as well just took out a gun and shot him.
Yeah, it was so poorly done and just out of place. You never see that couple again. They have no impact on the story. Him being a racist has no impact on his character other than it's just another bad quality about him.
Yeah. The theme is not very ambiguous in this movie.
No, not at all.
It's talking about the monsters of the past, 1950 monster, a universal monster movie. The monsters of our past aren't scary anymore, white people. Hint, hint, hint. Minorities, gays, they shouldn't scare you anymore, white
accept
America.
Accept everyone, exactly.
Accept them. We're putting it...
Interracial relationships.
Yes. And of course... So
disabled people, yeah.
Every one of us is just like, duh, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And it's really obvious you're saying that, and it's not a subtle metaphor, is what you're saying.
Right. So that I had was a worst scene of mine. Not the biggest mistake this movie made to me.
So what's worse for me? I'm asking myself a question here. This is a new turn of the podcast. Is Battle of the Sexes on the nose, saying what they want to say by literally writing it in the script, or is a metaphor that's just very obvious?
Well,
which is worse?
Well, the metaphor that's obvious at least is a throwaway scene. The Battle of the Sexes, the reason it you could feel it, it drags on so long because it takes so long to say the things that are very obvious. Right. So it's a bigger waste of time.
Well, they had to transcribe the entire Stronger Together speech.
Right. It's a bigger waste of time to sit through that stuff. Whereas, you know, a scene such as that where the black people come in and are excused.
At least this is dramatized. I mean, it's a heavy note that plays obvious, but at least it works within the framework of the story and this framework of the script. You have to show...
And for being so poorly done and in such poor taste that this was, I think, it only lasts for 2 or 3 seconds. I mean, it leaves a lasting impression because it's the wrong way to handle it, but it doesn't take up a majority of your screen time and it shouldn't take up a majority of your thought afterwards, which hopefully... I mean, it's a big deal, obviously.
Richard Jenkins needs the catalyst to send him back to Sally Hawkins to make him realize that all the things he pines for, all his fantasies, don't mean as much as the real friend he has in her.
Right.
And it works. As you know, again, it's obvious, but it works.
Bad scene number two. The song and dance number. You have a problem when we did Three Billboards.
Yep.
Of the flashback scene showing the daughter and the argument and it being on the nose, I hope you get raped too as she leaves, blah, blah, blah. And
too coincidental.
Yeah. Part of the reason you didn't like that is because it was a one-time use of that. It was a plot device to get the story moving in an emotional direction.
Right.
What's the difference between that and this here? I mean, this is a black and white dream sequence, essentially, a daydream sequence out of nowhere where she's a Broadway star singing and dancing and professing her love for the sea creature. Fine. You don't do that ever again in this movie. Yes, you have fantastical and fantasy scenes.
Here's what you do have, though. You have it building up to that. And I'm with you. It struck me as very awkward when I watched it.
Yeah, it has no place in this movie.
I'm not against you. It's just that they show on the television all the dance numbers with Shirley Temple.
Fine, yeah,
and
I get it.
They show what's on the movie screen.
I'm not arguing
any
of that.
They build up to the fact that in her mind, and it's very much in
she
her
can
mind,
speak. Yes, she's able to
declares
converse.
Her love for him in that scene. There's no ambiguity about whether or not she's in love with him there. I think that's the
point. So it can come down to it, like, does that need to be in the scene? Would you get the message that she's in love with this thing, whether that scene was in it or not? Because I had no problem understanding that.
Right.
Like,
again,
I don't see what it adds.
Yeah, it's a bit obvious in the storytelling.
And it's out of place.
Is it enjoyable?
No.
For some people? For you and me.
They should have. You know what would have made it enjoyable? If they put the fish man in a top hat and cane on top of it. Like, if you're going to cartoon the whole thing, cartoon him too. You know?
I have listened to a lot of podcasts where the critics have enjoyed that. So I don't know what audiences are feeling about that scene, where they love the scene.
Well, that's why maybe you listen to us, because they're wrong.
It's a love it or hate it scene. The second time I watched it, I didn't hate it. The first time I watched it, it's like, WTF, same reaction.
I just don't like...
I don't know.
I don't like it. I wasn't mad at it because it was on the nose. I was mad at it because it was out of place.
The second time, I mean, I enjoyed rewatching it so much because I watched you watch it for the first time, and I just the WTF look on your face made the movie for me.
Now,
as did
those two scenes, I'm willing to forgive. Okay, the third scene, and I'm gonna get loud, so turn your volume down. I don't need to see. You don't need to go all the way with the Sally Hawkins love story. Okay, and this isn't a racist thing. This isn't a trouble with the allegory thing. This isn't what do you mean? You have problems with people that sleep together that with interracial, or you have problems with a love story between a person and someone who's got a disability? No, I don't. I have a problem with a woman committing bestiality with a fish man. I don't need to see them having sex. I know you don't show it, but she doesn't need to disrobe and go all the way and talk about his little fish dick coming out there and fucking her. All right? That adds nothing to the story. It adds nothing to the story.
Here's my argument. So ready for devil's advocate. He's going to pounce and hit me with a steel chair any second. I have to make a lot of cutesy little jokes because he's really
nothing.
Angry. It adds something for his character. As that's my opinion.
So he can't feel love? He's going to be able to communicate and learn sign language and emote in other ways, but he can't explain that he's in love without sex?
You could argue that his attachment to her is merely Stockholm Syndrome and the fact that she is his one life raft.
But it's not, because we see him interact with other humans.
We spend a lot of time with her, right?
Yes.
Throughout the whole movie. We don't spend much time with him other than when it's from her POV. So why would he save her life at the end? And literally, you know, you're meant to think that they swim away and live together based on Richard Jenkins' voiceover narration to finish the film, which bookends the film. So why would he save her and bring her with her?
For the same reason he wouldn't do it to Michael Shannon's character. Because in the scenes we see them interact, he shows disdain and hate for Michael Shannon. In the scenes we've seen him and Sally Hawkins interact, he's shown love and appreciation for what she's done.
Dude,
you can relay emotions without being so
romance.
On the nose.
It's a fairy tale
but
romance.
But you don't need to. You didn't see Cinderella fuck the prince. You don't need to see
it. But it's
it.
A rated R Guillermo del Toro made for adults fairy tale.
And that's why the masturbation works. That's why the other stuff works. This rated
R
aspects
pay
of this.
Off the heavy sex in the beginning. She's rubbing one out to an egg timer, folks, in the beginning.
But it's,
and then I made
sense.
The joke
it
to
fits.
You.
Yeah, it was funny.
I handed you a make-believe Oscar. It was funny. You had to be that.
But
folks.
That makes sense in the scheme of, okay, she's this very regimented person, and this is her breaking from the norm, and she doesn't take these risks, but that superhero is inside all of us, regardless of our race, color, creed. You know, that makes sense. That masturbation
Listen, this
makes
wasn't
sense.
A Dennis Reynolds thing where they showed full penetration. This was
no,
basically...
It wasn't. It
was the derivation of the beautiful... drawing that was on Richard Jenkins, and even I, a steak eater who's just a grumbling old young man, an old man at heart. Even I look at that picture and say, oh, wow, that's very artistic. That's very beautiful. The picture of her embracing the, with her hair flowing, you know.
Yeah, but
I didn't
need Richard
man.
Jenkins to play Greg Kinnear's in As Good As It Gets either.
But he needed a reason to draw that,
right?
So that's
fine.
Why
I'm fine.
He drew
I'm
that.
Fine with all that. I'm fine with the creature decapitating the cat and Richard Jenkins not having a problem
with
it.
What did bathrooms cost to renovate back in the 1950s, 60s? Because it definitely didn't cost the 10 grand that it costs now. I mean, aren't people mad that she just floods her damn bathroom for fish
sex? That's where I'll suspend my disbelief. Because if you wanted to have a scene with the two of them swimming together and dancing in the bathroom, that's fine. You don't need to have her second thought and go back in the real world, which we're being shown, this real world, at least as far as Guillermo del Toro allows it, and her actually get ready to have sex with this thing. You don't need to show that. It's so on the nose. It's like, can you tell they're in love? Do you know they're in love? Let me make sure you know they love each other. Here's fish sex.
Well, here's
bestiality.
Listen, in
woman
terms
on
of
fish sex.
Merman sex goes.
Yeah,
well,
I
but it's not bestiality if he's
a
merman. But in terms of depictions of merman sex, this was a classy version of that. I mean,
how
if they
do you know? What does that statement mean? Wait a minute.
There's been one.
Yeah.
One merman sex scene. And this was a fairly classy version that ends in an artistic thing. Listen, I just think it strengthens his motivations. Because
and again, wait, I just want to finish off
my
saying.
Point.
I just want to finish off. I like this movie. I consider this a good movie. I think I gave it a BB+. But if your problem is on-the-nose stuff or too obvious stuff or hammering home a point that you don't need, that the audience doesn't need to have its hand held,
it's so bizarre,
it's
though, that it kind of, like, for the same reason you love David Lynch's new Twin Peaks, The Return, Michael,
great.
You argue with me before
it's
this
greatest.
Podcast.
It's the greatest.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the motivation of the artist is not something that's ambiguous here, but for that same reason, this is just so bizarre that it's like this curiosity watch, like I said.
Your first time watching this movie, were you okay with that scene?
I can't believe I'm watching this.
Were you okay with that scene?
I literally laughed. I laughed when it happened, which was
But why? Why did you laugh?
Because I was giddy about it. I can't believe they actually went through with this.
Okay.
That's what I said to myself.
All right, that's right. I'm willing to be – I'm not willing to die on
this. The second
time,
I laughed at you watching
yeah,
the scene.
That's the thing. This isn't a Harry and Tonto for me. Like, I'm not going to go crazy dying on this hill. I can understand why people would like it. For me – it just didn't serve any purpose. It's that and the dancing didn't serve any purpose in the movie. So that's my take. What about you for worst scene?
My worst scene, I mean, yes, the sexual harassment scene was tough to watch, and it was kind of prophetic. I mean, we can kind of
very,
get into that
I
in
mean,
a minute.
It was on the,
I mean, they made this in 2016,
of the times,
right?
Yeah. Unbelievable.
And that's like...
We sure Miramax didn't fund this?
Oh, my God. Listen, I'd probably say the worst scene is the movement with the Russian spies. I mean, they have, again, you're talking about on the nose, they have the, like, Russian scene through the Russian restaurant where they're singing the most stereotypical Russian song.
Yeah, they should have played the Russian version of the Godfather theme. Yeah.
They should have the national anthem playing in Ivan Drago.
Deutschland, Deutschland. Yeah, that's Germany. Never mind. Listen,
wow.
Sorry.
So the absurd stereotype of these Russian operators, we've seen it done so subtly and so well on the Americans, and then we see it with like these two goons in the movie, and the Russian character's like, and the lobsters were screaming, but this was delicious.
Yeah.
And Jenny takes a bite of the lobster, surf and turf, and he's a villain. He's a villainous.
Do you understand the subtext I am giving you?
I mean, it would have been better if they showed a character like that and then turn the tables and have him be actually a decent guy. So again, it's a little much. Like you said, it's heavy-handed.
Very.
And the theme is not ambiguous. You're literally talking about the monsters of 1960.
Do you think we should love one another?
Cold War.
Despite our colors?
We should like the color Russians no matter what.
What is the shape of water?
And if I could change, then you could change. Everybody could change.
I couldn't stop thinking about her water bill for that apartment after that swimming scene, the aquarium scene, and the never mind. Anyway,
your brother was just infuriated.
Oh, he was so angry, and it's funny because he's not as he's a layperson viewer, so he's the type where I think more eyes like his get on this product, the rating is going to go down. But he has no time for the ridiculousness, the artistic interpretations of Guillermo del Toro or anything like that.
So Guillermo del Toro might have hit it in one of those interviews. It's like, if you let your guard down in terms of
you
This is like a silly nonsense fairy tale.
You need to go
about
into
serious
this.
Things.
You need to go into this movie with an open mind.
Can you allow that to happen, yeah. right? Can you allow serious things to be talked about in a silly nonsense fairy tale or not?
Right. What about your best scene? What'd you have? Because there are a lot of scenes worth mentioning in this movie. It's a good movie.
I love the choreography of the prison break. I thought that was really cool. And I did think upon rewatch that it worked. I was a big fan of how the two plots with Michael Stuhlbarg and Sally Hawkins and Richard Jenkins, how those two came together. It was very necessary. So all those, the B and C plot, really, really worked mm-hmm. together well, and they're super necessary. Octavia Spencer making a big crisis decision in that sequence, too, really, to back her friend up, but then to have her go through with it.
I would love to see her play evil because I just cannot picture it. She just always gives into the right thing and the consciousness of the movie and doing the right thing at the wrong time or the right thing at the right time.
So I also love the introduction to Sally Hawkins' character, but I mean the big Oscar reel scenes and the two that are undeniable is when Sally Hawkins pleads to Richard Jenkins, telling him, so I'm mentioning five scenes. Sorry, I'm stealing five scenes. I'm somehow not falling on your best scene so far.
You haven't.
Oh, wow. So Richard Jenkins is being pleaded to. And those are great scenes between Richard Jenkins and his old boss. There's a lot of subtlety to those scenes. Again, Richard Jenkins, you know, performance within a performance, catnip to the Academy there. But
I want to edit you by saying, obviously, his former lover. I mean, I don't know that they ever consummated. I got the idea that they both have like a thing for one another. But
well, yeah. All right. So you're probably right there. Yeah. But maybe right, maybe not. I don't know.
I'm right. I'm always right.
They didn't show.
Yeah, they got no problem showing fish on woman's sex. But God forbid we show a little gay sex.
But Sally Hawkins obviously didn't convince you in her plea that this was a human entity, or at least on par with a human entity, even though freaking Okja is something you would die for. You would die for that freaking pig.
I ordered mine off Amazon last week.
And those porgs.
Should be in the mail any day now.
But an actual fish man who learns sign language.
If Luke Skywalker fucked the porg, I would have a problem with it. If tiny little Chinese girl had pig sex with an Okja, I'd have a problem with it.
But Okja has as much personality as...
But they're not humans! They are animals!
This is not an animal, though. This is a merman. This is Daryl Hannah. If they made... To girls, or to I'm really trying hard not to sound like three billboards right now. But the people that I've heard females describe him as attractive. I don't know. I'm not a gay man.
That's fine.
I never thought of him as attractive. I'm stuttering now because I secretly do. But no, I don't find this as a sensual movie.
Yes, he's obviously supposed to
Sally
be
Hawkinson
akin to an attractive male. He's got the six pack. He's ripped. He's like, yes, I get it. He's so very clearly fish. I don't know how to relay this anymore. It's bestiality.
I don't know. I think you might be racist for saying that against the merman species. The merman? Do you hyphenate it or you just say merman?
It's a law written down that you can't do this.
Listen, if a fish knew sign language... So are you against Captain Kirk with the
blue
aliens?
So that gorilla knows sign language, that famous gorilla.
Oh,
you're
true.
Saying you're okay with that gorilla just fucking whatever
absolutely
human
not.
It wants.
Absolutely not. Good point. That's a good point. You might have just won on that point right there.
Let that gorilla have fuck as many humans as it wants.
But I mean, at least they don't dance around with it. It's well, they literally dance around, but they don't dance around with the sex. It's a rated R fairy tale.
No, but
they show
don't...
them having sex. Do we have to have metaphors where they just like hug each other and
but that's the, that's
heavy
my whole
petting?
Problem, Mike. That's what I said. They did more than enough to establish a mutual love between them, between Sally Hawkins and the fishman. They did enough. They didn't need to go any further.
This is a female character as a protagonist. Why can't a female fantasy get a female sex payoff? She jerks off to an egg timer at the beginning of the movie. But we're going to get sex at the end of it.
That's to show that she's a regimented person because she does it by timer.
And that she also has sexual fantasies in the water.
That's fine. That's fine. Why can't you leave
you
it there?
You have to have a sexual payoff.
Why do you have
payoff?
To have... Why? Why does it need to fuck the fish?
If you have a sexual setup, it has to have a sexual payoff is all I'm saying.
Fine, fine. It's subjective, and I'm wrong for hating bestiality.
I don't know. You made a good point.
I'm in the minority because I don't want the gorilla to fuck women or men.
What else we got?
Because I think we need to have laws in the society
totally
to run.
Went off script for this entire time.
Can I give my best scene now?
Yeah. You go ahead. Give your best scene, Mike.
Well...
Wrong!
Because this movie is so...
It was the sex scene. It was the merman sex
scene. Fish
sex.
We had fish sex. That
got
was the answer.
I got you, Mike. I like the merman sex all along.
Oh, God. My best scene after that clusterfuck. Literally. It's odd to me because the most memorable scenes from this movie, to me, at least mm-hmm. from what I see, are going to be... Two scenes I actually said were the worst, with either the dance scene or the fish sex scene. I will comment that my favorite scene was the desperation in Michael Shannon's Strickland character when he confronts Octavia Spencer's Zelda in her own home. Zelda doesn't want to say a word, doesn't want to give up her friend Liza, even though she knows she's very aware that she's hiding Fishman in her apartment, and she goes stone cold silent, but it's once again the man who's bitched about the whole movie.
And yet you call it Fishman, you should call it Fish Thing. I win.
Fine.
Now I win. Now I take the upper hand.
But it's once again the man in the scene who all he has to do is what he's been complained about doing the whole time by the Octavia Spencer's character, which is just sit there and say nothing. All you have to do is nothing to get Michael Shannon out of the house, but instead it's the man who decides to speak up and take the action, just like Poe in Star Wars,
right.
Wants to drop bombs and ask questions later. He speaks up and gives up Liza and everything and tells
yep.
Michael Shannon.
Yep.
And that puts Michael Shannon on
and
his way.
And she's setting that up the whole movie,
yes.
talking about her husband,
yes.
Bruce.
I thought that was
home.
A great payoff.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
A well done.
And you know, it's Michael Shannon's desperation in that scene where he rips his fingers off, talking being
oh,
a biblical
yeah.
reference.
Bro, I love
There's
the,
so much
the fingers.
Good, yeah.
I love the black rotting fingers
yep.
of the
great
law.
Great subplot. Yes. The law.
Again, not so.
But that brings me to my next point. I think if Richard Jenkins is getting the push, like we've said, Michael Shannon, to me, was the shining star of this movie. And if how he's not getting supporting actor recognition is beyond me.
You know, you wonder if it's the more likable characters get the publicity.
It's very possible. We talked
this
about that with Three Billboards.
Hateable character, even though it's a fully conceived character. We see him at home screwing his wife. We see him... getting reamed out by his boss. We see him sexually harassing. So he assassinates himself as a character. You know he's a villain from the beginning. All right. It's not ambiguous. Like
no.
Nothing is from this plot line. So I don't know if the word is ham-handed, but
no, and I
it's
wish I
obvious.
Could put my finger. I wish I could put my finger on what I like, why I enjoyed this more than something like Battle of the Sexes, because they seem to be both so very blatantly in front of you with their messages. I haven't been able to parse through it and figure it out yet, but I do. I mean, this is a fun movie. It's a good message,
fun.
And it's fun to watch and fun to watch it play out. Would you like to defend any more felonious activities?
It's one of those movies that I think if the tone was wrong, you'd totally lose your darn mind. And if the payoffs weren't enjoyable. Here's something I wanted to talk about with you right from the jump and I forgot. This movie marketed itself on the poster with its very last shot.
Yes.
That was striking.
Something
to
I
me.
Noticed as well. And that's kind of what gave it away. And I think that was a good move. Posters do a lot of telling these days, man. The Spider-Man universe poster was turtled on its head because it's a Tony Stark movie. That's why he was figured so prominently. We talked about the posters for Mother in our September
right.
review, where it was kind of deceiving and it gave a lot of hints, but everyone thought it was a horror movie going in, a traditional horror movie, and the posters told a different story. This one's the same thing, like you just touched on. It gave away the subplot, the biggest running theme of the movie, which was this love story between Fish Thing and Sally Hawkins.
Listen, I mean, we're not gay men and we're not women who like men. So
both debatable.
But here's the thing. I mean, Tom Hanks screws Daryl Hannah. They don't show it in Splash. They go away with one another for life, leaving John Candy to deal with the police, just like they did leaving Richard Jenkins to deal with the police. Oh, we got a dead FBI agent. I wonder who's going to get in trouble for that.
What are you talking about? So you wanted to see Ariel and Prince Eric have sex after she got her fin back?
That's a long rated G metaphor for sex where they literally draw dicks in the clouds or in the shapes of the water.
Right, right. So, they did enough inferring is what you're saying. They made it obvious by other means is what you're saying.
At least they just
they didn't
get it
have
out of
to go the whole way is what you're saying. That's my point.
I'm okay with it. I'm just saying.
Hate you. I hate this podcast is over. This franchise has run its course.
It's a remake of Splash on the one hand, but it's also very and it's there's a lot of parallels with Splash. I mean, it's bizarre. The production
profile. It's been a
long time
since I've seen that movie, but yeah, it was
the production profile
of
this movie keeps coming back, right? The Creature of the Black Lagoon, right? He wants to make a movie where if the romantic interest of a monster movie, you know, that was brought to the forefront. The romance. King Kong with Faye Ray, right? King Kong with Naomi Watts. Okay, what if we actually played that out? All right. What if we played it out where the creature from the Black Lagoon gets with
if they accept it. Yeah, I
the
mean,
star.
It's something, maybe that's why I enjoyed
can
it.
Can that be a metaphor for things past should not be scary? Could that be a metaphor for, you know, the monsters of future
it's a good
past?
Point. It's no, something
days
I,
past, I don't know.
It's something I hadn't thought about. I mean, you know, maybe we enjoyed it because it was that type of, it's something we haven't seen before. You know, we don't know what happens if Frankenstein and Mrs. Frankenstein live happily ever after. You know,
and yet, I mean, again, another movie where G.I. Joe American, where FBI guy, where one of those strong male characters is the villain.
Yeah.
Is that going to get, you know, are we going to get
James
sick Bond of that
is
at
the
some
bad
point?
Guy, yeah.
Right.
Who knows? Know. It's interesting, but you can't have sex with sea life and get away with it on my watch. That's what we'll end with.
Points off for fish sex.
Do you have anything else you want to do?
I want to say a lot of South Park jokes now that I'm refraining from doing.
All right. Well, we'll save those for the comments section. All right, so that's going to take it for The Shape of Water. I mean, look, if there's a movie coming out that's going to get your opinion going, it's going to be this one.
Mike's eyes are bloodshot. The Red Bull has fully worn off.
I felt like I've been just at this for days. It's a billion o'clock right now. But let us know. Give us a comment. Shout us out. Mike, and Oscar on Facebook. Mike, and Oscar on Instagram. We are MM&O_pod on
Fish
Twitter.
Fish Sex. Would you like it?
Yeah.
Do you want some?
Mike and Oscar.
Can we help you with that?
@gmail.com. Oh, God.
Well, reach out to us. Costume.
Give us something. Give me a new co-host. Do something for us. Yeah, let
Does
us know
it
your
do
thoughts.
It for you.
Your thoughts. And keep hanging out with us. We're going to get you through this Oscar season and get you through the Golden Globes coming up at the beginning of January. Get you through the Oscar nominations at the end of January, all the way up through the big show, Hollywood's Biggest Night, coming up in March. So stick with us. Catch you.